Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, and each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your well-being, the well-being of your family and community, with everything that's going on in our world, the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the health of our society, the health of our democracy, the health of all the policies that regulate the things that can potentially damage our health, and of course, overall, the health and ecological balance of planet Earth and the ways that we can sustain that rather than destabilize our habitat and the habitat for all life here on Earth. So, that's a small order, isn't it? Each week on Connect the Dots, I talk with different authors, advocates, experts, thought leaders, filmmakers, activists, scientists, and artists about different facets of all the different things in our world that connect to our well-being and the well-being of all. So that's our show's theme. And this show, I'm very excited about. You may recall, regular listeners, that last week we had a program in which Lulu Freisdat came on and gave us an introduction to her fascinating work about election integrity, drawing attention to a report recently created just in the last month, completed, that answers a lot of questions and raises some more about what we need to do to protect the health of our democracy through protecting our vote. Lulu Freisdat is an Edward R. Murrow Award-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker. She received a Best Documentary Award for her first feature-length doc, Hollerback, Not Voting in an American Town. This is a film that explores systemic issues in our elections that discourage voter participation. In this election cycle, we can see how incredibly farsighted and deeply relevant for now her prior work background is and her prior commitment to this issue. She's also got extensive network news experience with editing assignments for CBS Evening News, Nightline, Sunday Morning. Hey, I worked for them at one time. The Today Show and Good Morning America. She's also worked on the team that produced Gideon's Army, an Emmy-nominated documentary that follows the personal stories of public defenders in the Deep South. So Lulu Freisdat is now returning to our show. She gave a wonderful highlight this previous week, and she's here today to discuss her recent report, An Electoral System in Crisis. And I just want to say, before I just give her a warm welcome back, that anyone who would, and I highly recommend it, follow along with our conversation today, is welcome to go to the website where this report is located, and that is electoralsysteminCrisis.org. And today we're going to be talking about highlights of the report, and who knows, maybe we'll do a future show that's a call-in in which people can ask questions if there's enough interest in that. I think that might be very interesting to do because this is groundbreaking information in electoral system in crisis. So welcome back to Connect the Dots, Lulu Freisdat.
Thank you so much for having me. And if anyone wants to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Lulu Freisdat.
Great, great. And so that's terrific. So, you know, I have ever since, as I mentioned, I believe last week, ever since the primary elections between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton in New York, in which, 125,000 people were purged from the rolls, just not allowed to vote at all. And then the whole time that the primary moved across the country, I was very concerned, would similar events be happening? And lo and behold, they seemed to be. And there was sort of mounting anecdotal evidence of different kinds that there was something was funny and not right with our election system. And, of course, all of this was leading to the vote of this, you know, the second largest state, California. I was in touch with people working for the candidates in that state, expressing concern about what that vote would be. And now we know in 2020 hindsight, 2.5 million people were left with uncounted votes the day following the election. I had some people on the show talking about the issue of the vote. the very next day after the election. So there have been, and ever since then, there's been a lot of people going at this with numbers, with statistics, raising questions, hypothesizing, looking at various issues. And when your report came out, it was just on a different order of level of credibility that both confirmed some of these anecdotal worries, though not all of them, but more important, gave a very solid, fact-based, statistical analysis. And so that's what we're going to be discussing today. And I realize that it isn't everybody's, you know, kind of easiest frame of reference, but we do need to rely on the numbers to get a sense of what the problem is. So let's begin, if we can, Lulu, by talking about where America stands in relationship to the integrity of our vote. We call ourselves a democracy. Is our democracy, in terms of, you know, how we're capturing one person, one vote, really functioning as we hope?
Based on the evidence from our report, we do not think so, no.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
We did a statistical analysis of the election results going back to 2000, and what we found was that starting around 2008, we started to see highly irregular statistical patterns in the election results, and we focused to a large extent on the 2016 election. We analyzed 21 different states, and what we found was that in the vast majority of those states that we looked at, we did find statistical irregularities. And what I mean by that is we found patterns that did not follow laws of mathematics. And our concern is that these irregularities could be caused by fraud or manipulation. And in fact, after exploring different possibilities for why these patterns are irregular, for example, is it due to error? Is it due to demographics? We came away with the conclusion that the most likely explanation is some kind of fraud or manipulation.
Wow. So, you know, we've kind of, all the things that, you know, we kind of hope would mitigate that finding, you looked at them scientifically and kind of were able to, by the nature of the numbers, reveal them to be off the table and not what was happening. Can you tell our listeners, give them a certain insight into the background mathematics in your approach? Because we have seen, those of us who are aware of this issue, have seen other projections based solely on exit poll projections and, you know, the differentials with exit poll projections. Do you use exit polls, and how do you you know, how is the statistical basis of what you're looking at different from just straight going, we have a deviation from election polls here?
We don't use exit polls at all. And in fact, that's one of the strengths of the report, because an exit poll is not an actual election result. It's a survey. Mm-hmm. It's basically asking someone a question when they come out of the polls. And it can be impacted by whether or not, you know, enough people are sampled, some people not wanting to be sampled, people deciding they don't want to actually say who they voted for. There's all kinds of things that could impact exit polls. So mm-hmm. although I am concerned about the exit polls and the discrepancy between the exit polls and the reported totals, I would consider that more of a red flag. Whereas what we're doing is actually analyzing the actual election results. And our process is based on the law of large numbers. And the law of large numbers is a mathematical principle, and it says that as a sample size grows, its average will get closer and closer to the average of the whole population. So what that means is that the larger and larger sample you have, the more accurate the sample is going to be in terms of telling you what is the average of the whole set of numbers that you're looking at. And it's really the basis for all polling. It's the basis for, you know, any kind of estimates that we make in terms of, you know, popular opinion. You sample larger and larger numbers of people, and as you get into those large numbers, you start to get an average of what people think or how people will act. And when you apply that to election results, and we graph this visually so that you can see it, what it means is that after you count a certain number of votes, you should see in an expected statistical pattern that the candidate's average percentage will start to show up. So example, and this is this is true for hand-counted counties. So for example, there's a county in New York, Columbia County, and they count their ballots by hand. They have optical scan machines, but at the end of the day, they take their ballots out of the optical scan machines and they sit down in public there at the precinct and they count usually 100% of the ballots by hand. And when you look at the statistical graph of that county, you will see that after about 1,300 votes, each one of the candidates hits basically a flat line. So by that point, you've reached the average percentage that that candidate is receiving from all of the different votes. You know, maybe someone in one precinct, maybe a bunch of people supported Sanders, or in another precinct, a bunch of people supported Clinton. But by the time you hit around in that county, around 1,300 votes, you see that the candidates' percentages hit an average. And it stays that way all the way through the rest of the votes. And that's because the law of large numbers tells you that once you hit a large enough number, you will hit the average. And that is the basis of all of the analysis that we did, although we did actually, we did a number of different analysis, and that's one of the reasons why we're confident in our work, is because we looked at this a number of different ways. But this analysis, which is called the cumulative precinct vote tally graph, this was the kind of the foundation of our work. And what we saw was that in quite a few elections, as I said, in the majority of the elections that we looked at in the 2016 primary, instead of the votes hitting an average, they would continue to increase for one candidate or decrease for the other candidate. And we graph these from smallest precinct to the largest precinct. So as you get into the larger and larger precincts, we will see one candidate getting a larger and larger percentage of the vote and another candidate getting a smaller and smaller percentage of the vote. And those, which candidate is getting more votes and which candidate is getting less votes is consistent. It doesn't switch. So, for example, in the 2016 primary, Clinton is always getting more votes when you go into the larger precincts when you have these irregularities, and Sanders is always getting less. And in the Republican race, actually, what we found was that Trump is almost always getting fewer and fewer votes as you go into the large precincts, and other Republican candidates, more establishment candidates, whether that was Cruz or Rubio, would be getting more and more votes as you went into the larger precincts. And really, that is a statistical irregularity. And then we looked at, were there perhaps demographic explanations for it? We couldn't find a demographic explanation that would explain this pattern happening in such a wide variety of demographics. You know, I mean, we found this pattern in Wisconsin, in Illinois, in Louisiana, in Alabama, in Delaware, I mean, Connecticut, Massachusetts. We found it all over the country. So it seems implausible then that there is one demographic explanation that could cover this pattern in such a wide number of geographies and with such a broad spectrum of demographics. And that was just one of the reasons why we ruled out demographics as a possibility for explaining it. But what we did
Let me ask you a question. Which is, why would it be that when you get into a larger voter group, you know, a larger precinct or something like that, the larger increase in the percentage of one candidate over another is suspect or telltale in some kind of way? But why is that statistically an anomaly?
Because it violates the law of large numbers. By the time you have 200,000 votes, there is no mathematical reason why a percentage should still be going up and up and up. You should have hit an average by that time. By the time you poll 200,000 people, you should know which movie they want to see. The results shouldn't just keep changing. So it has to do with, I mean, this is a mathematical principle that was proven in 1744 by a mathematician named Bernoulli. And it's one of the founding principles of probability theory. So when you have elections where you see, after 200,000 votes, as we see in Louisiana, you still see those percentages going up and up and up, you know, this is a violation of mathematical principles. And that is why we say that it's irregular and why we say that it's suspicious. And I will say that this is not just me. So some of the people... I think you have to look at the people on the team. So our collaborator was Dr. Fritz Schurin, who is a vice president of NORC, one of the leading organizations that does statistical analysis. And he's also a former president of the American Statistical Association. And I want to just read to you, you know, his quote in terms of when he saw our data, because he vetted our data extensively. And what Dr. Schurin said was, let me just find his quote here.
Yeah, so we're waiting for that quote. That sounds good. Yeah. So you were
let
actually...
Let me see, I have it here. So
you got
Dr.
It? Okay,
Schurin
great.
Said, as a statistician, I find the results of the 2016 primary voting unusual. In fact, I found the patterns unexpected and possibly even suspicious. There is a greater degree of smoothness in the outcomes than the roughness that is typical in raw, real data. And what he's saying by that is that this data is highly suspect. And when he's talking about raw, real data, and he's talking about the roughness, he's talking about when you have real data that's not fabricated or manipulated, you know, that you've actually gotten from real voters, you would see bumps in the data. You would see, you know, one person voted for Sanders and one person voted for Clinton and three people voted for Trump and then eight people voted for Cruz. And, you know, you see the chart kind of, it has little bumps on it. But when you look at something like the Louisiana graph of this election, it is a straight line. You could draw it with a pencil and a ruler. And that is why, you know, you're hearing someone with Dr. Schurin's expertise say that he finds those results suspicious.
So in other words, it's almost like it's like almost machine-like in its it
well,
doesn't
that's
follow
one of the other
the
things
vicissitudes of the human project in a certain kind of way. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it actually follows a mathematical algorithm, and the line goes up in a mathematically precise way as you get into larger and larger precincts. And we actually have one of the analysts on the team, Phil Evans, who is the one who designed this method, who has started to reverse engineer these algorithms. And what he does is he takes the election results and he figures out a factor by which he can turn those election results into a normal-looking election pattern, like a flat line. And he's coming up with, you know, integers, like 1.5 or 2. And when he creates an algorithm, reverse engineering with, say, 200%, this pattern in one election, he will turn an irregular statistical pattern into a very normal-looking statistical pattern. And what that says to me is that it was engineered with an algorithm to begin with by somebody manipulating the totals.
Of course. That really makes a lot of sense. In other words, you could only create something like that with the machine. The normal human vote wouldn't do that. And so let's just get a little one that makes complete sense to me. Let's just get a little bit clearer. You're saying then the implication of this is that there was somebody with access to the voting machines and in some electronic programmed way they could put in something that, and I'm talking as a straight non-math person here, they could enter in something that would control these algorithms, you know, someone with computer expertise, and produce the kind of outcome. Is that the scenario whereby the results that you see could have been possibly produced?
It's a distinct possibility. Absolutely. And when you have to look at the experts now who are saying that this is possible. So you have to look at someone like Bruce Schneer, who is, if you look at his website, he's an internationally renowned security technologist, written 13 books on security called Security Guru by The Economist. And, you know, he wrote an essay in The Washington Post saying, by November, Russian hackers could target voting machines, as in, yes, it's really possible. And if it's possible, and we've had these machines in use since 2002, why wouldn't you think someone had done it by now? And in fact, you can look at articles from other extremely knowledgeable people. For example, Ron Rivest, who is an award-winning computer expert. Let me pull up his quote from the Boston Globe. He mm-hmm. said he would be surprised if it hadn't happened already. So
he'd be surprised.
Yeah, he said, this is what Ron Rivest said. Ron Rivest is a founding father of modern encryption systems and a MIT professor who won the Turing Award, computer's version of the Nobel Prize. And Ron Rivest said, I wouldn't be surprised, in light of the DNC, that major voting systems have been compromised. So there he's saying he wouldn't be surprised if it had already happened. And there are, in fact, so many ways that these machines can be accessed. There is actually research out that the machines have a program running in them that could create a fractional vote, which means that one person's vote could be allocated, say, a third, and another person's vote could be allocated times three. And by doing that, you could drastically alter the outcome of the vote. And that's a program that research has indicated is already running in a number of these voting machines, the GEMS machines, which run about 25% of the country right now. But really, that is just one possibility. They have been shown to be vulnerable to viruses, which can be easily injected through normal election procedures. They've been hacked by panels being removed and replaced. There's just so many different ways that these machines have been hacked.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, based on what you're finding, there may not, ever since 2002 or so, we could have been experiencing interventions, undesirable interventions into our elections. And is it
interventions? I do think that the Help America Vote Act could have some, some unintended connotations. So, yeah, that was how all of this electronic equipment was introduced, with the Help America Vote Act in 2002. And really, if we go back to the data, and again, I think that's one of the things that we emphasize about our research, is that it's evidence-based. What the data indicates is that starting around 2008, we started to see unusual or suspect statistical patterns. And I'm not saying that they didn't appear before that. We have not sampled as many races as I would like, but certainly when we looked at the races that we looked at from 2000 were absolutely regular patterns. These followed the law of large numbers. The support for candidates in the small and large precincts was almost identical. The 2000 elections graph as a flat line, which is what we would expect. So we definitely have seen a radical departure since 2000 of the statistical pattern of election returns. And based on other evaluations that we made, as I said, trying to see where the demographic explanations for this, our ultimate conclusion was that it seemed associated with the electronic voting equipment. And one of the main reasons we say that is because we do not see those irregular statistical patterns in hand-counted precincts. When we looked at hand-counted precincts in both Wisconsin and in New York, in Columbia County, those hand-counted precincts had the normal, regular statistical patterns, the expected statistical patterns that we saw from 2000. It was only the electronic voting equipment that had the irregular statistical patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to add here, too, I just want to get the word out also. There is our team really does support hand-counted paper ballots, and there is going to be a day of action starting September 27th to advocate for hand-counted paper ballots. And if people are live-tweeting this or interested in spreading the information, the hashtag is ElectionAction. And I also encourage you to connect with Election Justice USA, which is going to be a leading organization in that. And I think Election Justice USA has an email, electionjusticeusa@gmail.com. I encourage people to get in touch with them, volunteer, or work through your own election integrity organizations. This is something that we all really need to advocate now, is hand-counted paper ballots to try to get back to honest elections.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're not saying that through this upcoming action, this is a long-term plan. It isn't that we're going to be able to get a handle on this in time for this coming season's presidential and, congressional vote. I mean, is it for the next election, or is it more long-term? What is your plan there?
I wouldn't give up on the 2016 election. Like, let's not just throw up our hands and say, well, the election's going to be rigged. There's nothing we can do. You know, we still have some time. And we spoke with Virginia Martin, who is the election commissioner at Columbia County, where they do hand-counted paper ballots. And she said if there were commissioners around the country who decided they wanted to do hand-counted paper ballots and they put their minds to it, they could put it together within 2 to 3 weeks. They've just got to print the ballots, and they've got to put absolutely. This is so doable. This is what people do not understand. This is so doable. And there are precincts around the country that have done this for years. In New Hampshire, they count the ballots by hand in their precinct, and there are protocols for this. Virginia Martin is going to put a PDF together advising election commissioners on the protocol. We have video footage of hand-counted paper ballots, so election commissioners can see what it looks like. You get teams of volunteers in, and you basically have four people per ballot. You have one person who reads the ballot out loud. You have another person who marks it down by hand. And then you have one person monitoring each of those person. One person monitors the person who's reading the count to make sure that they read the count accurately. And then you have a person who monitors the person who's writing it down to make sure that they have written it down accurately. So you have four people on each ballot. And there are volunteers all over the country who want to do this. I'm talking about Democrats, Republicans, progressives, libertarians. People want their votes counted accurately, and they have a right to that. And there is no reason why we couldn't implement this in counties all over the country. And there are two great things that would happen from that. One is that we would do it, and we would have confidence. It would give us confidence that it could be done if we tried it, if we started doing it in some counties. And the other is that it would give us a baseline to compare, especially statistically. We would be able to compare results of hand-counted counties all over the country with results of the electronic machines. And, you know, we would start to be able to very rapidly identify where there were issues, even more so than we've already done. So I certainly encourage people to reach out to their local election commissioners. There are approximately 8,000 to 9,000 election jurisdictions in this country, and it's going to take a lot of local effort. This is people caring about their elections locally and getting involved in their board of elections and saying, I care about this, I want to spend time on this, and let your commissioners know that you want hand-counted paper ballots.
That's fantastic. So in other words, however much we're able to do this and wherever we're able to do it, more people's votes get counted, and it's a real win. That's absolutely fantastic.
Think about the confidence boost. Think about the confidence boost from people knowing that the votes in those counties were counted accurately.
Yes. I mean, because really, there's doubt about that. I mean, there's kind of a thing where we know that international measures say that we don't really have good election integrity. We're not high on the list. It's another measure in which we kind of have an exalted opinion of how well we're doing that isn't borne out by what people objectively say when they look at it. It's not confirmed by what your study finds, but, you know, it's kind of hard to get our minds around. But one of the reasons is that, you know, sometimes people don't want to hear it. My candidate won, but as you point out, this is nonpartisan. Everyone has to, you know, basically care about a democratic outcome. But the other reason is that people don't think there's anything they could do about it. So it feels rather hollow to, you know, proceed to get through certain initiatives without the sense that, you know, our votes would count and we have the ability to do that. And so people get turned off. So this is like one of the single most important things that, you know, that people can do to really have a sense of participation and optimism that the voice of the people can be heard in the election system. So I really applaud you for that. So once again, the hashtag is Election Action, right?
Yeah.
And your upcoming event is coming up September 27th. And people can also, is that right? Or
yeah, we're going to start September 27th. Now, the idea is hopefully that this will be a rolling action so that every Tuesday we'll have Democracy Tuesday and we'll keep building momentum up to the election and even after the election, because this is reforming our electoral process is a long-term process, and we really want to engage people on a long-term nationwide basis. But so right now, Election Action, September 27th, and ongoing Democracy Tuesdays.
Okay, that's great. And they can also go to electoralsystemincrisis.org in order to read the report. Now, let's just go back and talk a little bit more about the report. How many states were you actually able to look at, and how long has this project been going on? I mean, when did you begin this research endeavor or plan to do it, or, you know, how did, what's the time sequence first of that? Because, I mean, you didn't begin 2 weeks ago, right? You had to have some forethought, and you'd worked on this earlier film, you know, which we discussed in our earlier program and everything like that. So how long has the project been going on, and how many states were you able to get information on?
I started on this research around June of 2015, so a little more than a year ago, and we analyzed in 2016 alone 21 states, and we also looked at elections from five different cycles, 2000, 2004, 2008, 2012, and some congressional and governor's races in between. So we looked at a lot of races. And I just want to add to that last point that you make about people feeling powerless. There was this study that came out from NORC and the AP that 9 in 10 Americans lack confidence in the country's political system. And that is just heartbreaking to me. That is 90% of our population that has lost faith. I mean, that makes me want to cry, I have to say. So, yeah, this is something, I do think it is the most important issue that we can work on, and I do think it's a bipartisan issue that everybody needs to get involved in. So, yeah, but back to the report, the reason that sort of level of disengagement is what motivated me to do the research. I really felt like there's a reason why so many people are disengaged and so distrustful, and let's get some data on the table. There's really, we have to stop all the speculation, and we have to get some data. So I had heard about this this study, it's this method, I should say. It's called the Cumulative Precinct Vote Tally Chart. And it was actually designed by an analyst named Phil Evans. He's an engineer, and he was someone who was following the 2012 primary. He was a Ron Paul supporter, and he and a number of the Ron Paul supporters noticed that Ron Paul's support seemed to get lower and lower in the large precincts. And Phil Evans in particular was the one who really caught this. And he does a lot of algorithms in his work. He has a small business. He makes manufacturing equipment. And so he has to do a lot of algorithmic work. And he started looking at that pattern. He saw that Ron Paul would have a certain percentage in the small precincts and how it would plummet in the large precincts. And he saw Mitt Romney's support going from the not very much in the small precincts, and then all of a sudden, you know, skyrocketing in large precincts. In fact, they were seemed to be kind of flipping. Romney seemed to wind up at the level where you would have thought Ron Paul would wind up at, and Ron Paul would wind up at the level where you thought Mitt Romney would wind up at. And Evans thought this was very strange, and he started to look at the data and analyze it, and he spent about 6 weeks on it, and he came up with this way of analyzing the data. And then he was working with a lot of Ron Paul supporters. These were kind of amateur analysts online in different forums. And it was very much outside of the mainstream statistical community, which is one reason that it didn't get much play or even respect within the statistical community. These were people working under kind of pseudonyms. I think Phil had a handle at the time, you know, like a fake name on the forum, and a lot of other people did. So this was kind of something that wasn't academic by any means, but it doesn't mean that the math wasn't correct. And I think that's what I really zoned in on in my work. I didn't care about where it, you know, came from, or, you know, who had started it. I wanted to find out if it was accurate. And so what Phil's kind of brilliance was that he figured out that if you took the data from an election and you lined it up from the smallest precinct to the largest precinct, you could actually see this pattern very clearly. And no one had done that before. And so they watched all through the 2012 primary. They saw Ron Paul lose election after election through this pattern where his votes would plummet in the large precincts, and they were very suspicious. But because they were working in this very unconventional environment outside of academic circles, no one in academic circles paid much attention to that research until someone named Beth Clarkson, who has a PhD in statistics and works at an aeronautics agency, took a look at the research, and she was very surprised. And I interviewed her, and I spoke with her about her research, and she said when she went into it, she thought, this can't be anything real, you know? What is the stuff that they're doing? And she replicated their research, and she agreed with them, and she agreed with their conclusions. And she has said that the patterns that we're seeing are what one would expect if there was manipulation of the vote. So mm-hmm. Beth Clarkson was really the first academic statistician who put this research on the map. Yeah.
All right. I just want to ask another question because I know that this is in people's minds. From the 21 states, I mean, first of all, not every state had a primary. So from your data that you gathered in the 21 states, would you say that your findings lean toward, indicate, or do not indicate that actually the outcome of the primary may have been different than what the conventionally accepted outcome is?
Right. We found a difference in the Democratic and the Republican race. So in the Democratic race, we absolutely found that these were numbers large enough to have affected the outcome. And our estimate is 12.82%, that the results were off by approximately 13%. And when you do the numbers on that, what it does is it takes a 3.8 million vote lead that Clinton had, and it brings it down to about 200,000 votes. And then you have to take into account that Sanders also had approximately 130,000 votes from the caucuses. And so then it brings Clinton's total, the number of votes that Clinton might have been ahead down to approximately 74,000, which is very different than 3.8 million. Now you're talking about a very tight race, and you're talking about estimates. So if the estimate was a little high, a little low, then, you know, that absolutely could have changed the outcome of the race. And you're also talking about a race that was in the midst of what we call an environment of corruption. And that's one of the things we talk about in the report, is that there were so many other factors in terms of these election results. There was documented voter suppression in state after state. There was registration tampering. There were people's names being deliberately pulled from the rolls. In Brooklyn alone, it was 120,000 people whose names were deleted from the rolls. So when you're talking about potentially a 74,000 vote lead and 120,000 people in Brooklyn alone are pulled from the rolls, you are talking about a race that definitely could have been changed by this manipulation, if there was manipulation. So that's on the Democratic side between Sanders and Clinton. On the Republican side, we did not think that the results were enough to have changed the outcome, which is one reason why we haven't focused on that race to the extent that we have on the Democratic race. In general, on the Republican side, it was Trump's votes who were being pulled down, it was Trump's votes that showed a lower percentage in the large precincts. So the irregular statistical patterns seem to indicate that Trump was potentially losing votes in those large precincts. And because Trump was able to win the primary anyway, that's why we said in the Republican side, we did not think that if there was manipulation, it would have been enough to change the outcome. But on the Democratic side, yes, we did think it was enough.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask another question. These are all kind of, this may be outside the range of what your study could show, because you're dealing with this large math and the number of the results and everything. But one of the things that happens is that people naturally are wanting to know, and maybe you can't even comment on that, but they're wanting to know, how could this happen? Was this something that would have to be organized on a precinct-by-precinct level? Would it be organized on a state-by-state level? How many, is it something where at some statewide or national level someone could flip a switch? I mean, how was it organized? How many people would need to be recruited into this, or is it a question of, you know, a couple of technicians traveling around and, you know, like, how could it actually be enacted? I don't know that you would have any insights into that, but I'm sure a lot of people wonder because, you know, it goes all the way from people who don't think it's possible ever for any reason to people who think that, you know, let's say Hillary Clinton personally went around, you know, or just whispered to somebody and such a thing could happen. So love to hear where you kind of stand on all of that.
First of all, I think it's really important to keep in mind that because a candidate benefits from something
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean that that candidate caused
Did
that.
It.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't
yep.
know. I think we really have to say that we don't know who is doing this or how it's being done or if it's being done. We don't have proof. Even our research, as strong as it is, as evidence-based as it is, it's not proof. These are statistical
mm-hmm.
patterns that we're looking at. And what would be proof
mm-hmm.
that the machines are not counting the votes accurately is if we could go to a state like New York where we did have highly irregular statistical patterns and we have paper ballots, and it would be great if we could count those ballots by hand and compare them to the machine totals. And we did actually have a small sample of that because in Brooklyn there were all the affidavit ballots, and Election Justice USA had volunteers who counted some of those votes by hand as the Board of Elections officials were feeding them into the machines. And so
mm-hmm.
we did have a small subsample where we compared the hand-counted ballots to the machine count, and the results were significantly different. In every assembly district that they counted, except one, Sanders received a higher percentage of the vote when the volunteers counted those ballots by hand than when the machines ran them. So we do have some indication that there, you know, further beyond statistical patterns, that there is some sort of issue with the electronic voting equipment. But again, we don't know how it's happening. We don't know who's doing it. What I would really emphasize is how simple it is and how hard it is to detect. So for example,
mm-hmm.
Clint Curtis, who testified under oath that he was asked to and did design a program to flip votes,
mm-hmm.
said that it was 24 lines of code and you'd never see it.
Mm-hmm.
That is how simple it is, that is how minimal it is, and how hard it is to detect. So
mm-hmm.
when people say, how could this happen? It seems impossible. I had at times on our team really three people working intensively, myself and two analysts. And I think based on that, because those guys that I was working with were really good and really fast, and they could analyze the state's results sometimes in 24 hours, I think
mm-hmm.
you could do it with three people. I think you could have one person who is really good at a really strong analyst who could figure out your percentages. You could have a really strong hacker who knows how to do it, and you could have somebody coordinating and figuring out how it needs to get done. So when people talk about conspiracy, I don't know. I actually think this could be done with an extremely small team.
Mm-hmm. And that team would not have to be in location. In other words, they're not there in Brooklyn, you know, going into the election office late at night and playing with something. It could be done by a computer at a distance.
I honestly don't know, but that
mm-hmm.
is, I mean, certainly that's, that's that seems to be what is indicated by the people who have done this. If you look at people like
okay.
J. Alex Halderman, look at the times when it's actually been done. J. Alex
mm-hmm.
Halderman is a professor of computer security at University of Michigan. And he's been hacking voting machines since he was a grad student at Princeton. I filmed him. And you can see a clip of that hack on the website for my film. My film is hollerbackfilm.com is the website. And click on film clips and watch that first clip, 5 minutes, and you will see how they hacked this AccuVote TS. But he did another hack. He's famous. He's hacked, I mean, it famous within the election hacking community.
Uh-huh.
He did another hack that was amazing of the DC internet pilot test program. And by remote control, they hacked into this pilot voting program in Washington, DC. And they took over every single aspect of the election. They changed election results. They changed the outcome of the election. They took over the cameras that were monitoring the election inside the room. And
wow.
They also implanted on the machine the University of Michigan fight song so that after you were done voting, the machine would play the University of Michigan fight song. And they did that by remote control. And this is the most scary part. While they were in there hacking that system, they found attempts from Iran and China who were also trying to get into the system. So they blocked out those hackers from Iran and China. But this has been going on for years. That DC pilot program was years ago that they did that. So, and the hackers are getting better and better all the time. So when people say, oh, this isn't possible, you know, have you talked to your local hacker? Have you talked to your local 14-year-old? Like, it's possible.
Oh my goodness. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. That's really funny. I mean, I think through this conversation, people are really getting a much clearer, kind of straight up image of how this all can happen. But, you know, what I find is, and of course, working in the media, as you do, as I do, et cetera, we know that you can kind of hang a bad jacket on an understanding or a concept or something that's going on through putting a name on it. So, for example, if you call something a conspiracy theory, it will, you know, on the one hand, if it really hasn't been well validated and well documented, I wouldn't call it a conspiracy theory. I would say this isn't well enough documented to be convincing to me. But I wouldn't cast an aspersion on somebody entertaining a notion based on early anecdotal evidence. This is how we investigate. This is what we, you know, causes us to look into things. So, you know, I wouldn't invalidate that sense of investigation and frighten people away from considering things. At the same time, how well validated is it? But, you know, in this election, because I guess of the Trump factor, or maybe for other reasons, or people's imperfect understanding of democracy or wishful thinking about our democracy, you know, for some people, it's kind of more self-evident that all of the anecdotal information that we've seen up till now and now is validated by your more scientific approach, you know, where there's smoke, there could be fire, let's say. But for others, it's kind of like a don't go there, this is mad conspiracy thinking, not something that bears investigation. You know, I'd love, again, to hear, you know, your comments on and what you encounter as you communicate about this with people. Like how open they are, how close they are, why it's hard for us, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think the term conspiracy theory is one that is not helping us at all. Because what has happened with the term conspiracy theory, first off, it's jumped the shark. Everything's a conspiracy theory now. But secondly, it's become a way of shaming people from asking legitimate questions. And people do need to ask legitimate questions. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's what democracy is about, the public questioning, challenging, and overseeing its elected officials and its media. So yes, the public does need to be questioning whether or not the election results are accurate. And yes, they do need to be asking questions about why the media isn't covering these issues. And the media has not been covering the issue of election fraud. The media itself is perhaps intimidated by the term conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theory is a kind of a shaming technique that's being used to keep people from looking at this. So what, unfortunately, the consequence of that is when the organizations that we expect to vet material for us and present solid information for us refuse to do that and abdicate their responsibility, then other less well-trained sources are going to wade in. And if people can't get information they want from the media, and in general, if you look at the if you look at the polls of the trust that people have in the media, it's very low. When they can't trust their media, they will go to, you know, whoever they do trust. And unfortunately now, so many different pockets of the population trust all kinds of different corners of people providing information, and there is no consistent vetting going on anymore, and no one knows who to trust. I myself look at such a broad spectrum of media before I try to figure out anything. I mean, you have someone like Trump, who is simultaneously saying that the elections are rigged, which I think there is, you know, a good deal of evidence to support, and also saying that President Obama is not a citizen of the United States and is the leader of ISIS, you know, which I think there's not much evidence to support. So when you have, you know, people do not know who to go to for information anymore. And it is part of the overall problem that we have right now. We have a problem of conflict of interest.
Right.
Conflict of interest in so many different areas. Conflict of interest in the media. Conflict of interest in our elections. So because of these conflicts of interest, because money has infiltrated everything, we no longer have a really functioning democracy. And in fact, that is what studies are pointing to. So there was another study that I just found this morning, actually, that came out in 2014, a Princeton study that basically said the United States is an oligarchy. And that is based on evidence. They basically, what they did was they looked at positions that the average citizen is supporting and saw whether or not those positions were being implemented into policy, and often they were not. And then they looked at positions that were being supported by financial elites and large moneyed interests, and they looked to see were those policy positions being implemented, and the answer was yes. More often, those policy positions were being implemented, and that's why this study basically came down with the conclusion that the United States is currently an oligarchy. And so
in the TPP, for example. You know, it doesn't serve any group of American citizens. They're opposed to it. The media actually fails to cover it, hides it from our awareness. And then the president says he's going around to bring it to the people, and he goes around and he talks to the heads of large companies and businesses, and clearly it empowers corporations. It stands at the risk of being passed in the weeks, immediately following the election. And it doesn't serve the American people at all. And how do we get a handle on elected officials who are subject to such influence? So, I mean, I think you're absolutely right, and this is the big concern and the worry, and I agree that, if we don't fix the vote, we have absolutely no handle on it, even though, you know, there's no potential to vote out people who are corrupted by this money and bring in other folks, and that's our only hope, so this is a very crucial effort in that regard, so it's key to everything that this election was about, this primary has been about, and it's key to the risk we now face when, you know, we have a lunatic on one side and a corporatist on the other, which is really, you know, not a great choice for enacting people or environmentally centric policies. So I completely, it's that conflict of interest. And this is like, if we don't have that handle, if in fact there's strong evidence that this should have been, would have been, was a contested primary result, then, you know, there it is in spades. We don't know who's doing it. But as your organization, Election Justice USA, is saying, hand-counted ballots are the way to intervene in this situation. So would you please, as we kind of come down to the last 5 minutes or so of our show, just regroup people on what they can do to participate in taking action around this?
Right. I do want to say that the team members in my report, Dr. Schur and myself and the lead statistician Anselmo Sampietro all strongly advocate for hand-counted paper ballots. And our report was done in collaboration with Election Justice USA, which is also advocating for hand-counted paper ballots. And one of the reasons I say this, if you look at the report and you look at New York, which is a state that does have optical scan ballots. I know a lot of people are saying optical scan ballots are the way to go and will protect us. The New York results were highly irregular. The statistical patterns did not look, they were not the expected statistical patterns. And in all likelihood, the results in New York, even though we did have optical scan machines with paper ballots, in all likelihood, those results were also manipulated. So what we're advocating for are hand-counted paper ballots. That means you have a paper ballot, and it's marked by the voter, and then it is counted by hand that night in the precinct in a transparent process that is open to scrutiny by the media and the public and has secure chain of custody. That means those ballots don't go anywhere. No one handles them. They are under observation at all times. And if we do that, that is our best hope of having accurate results. And we're going to start these actions on September 27th. The hashtag is Election Action. You can go to Election Justice USA to get more information about that. I just really encourage people to get involved. I think this is the number one place to start. This is ground zero of where we start to really implement a true democracy.
Thank you. That's really awesome and important. And I think people would do really well to go to your website and read the report, get more detail, pass this radio program along to your friends, repost it, tweet it, do all the above. And, you know, if people have questions, please do feel free to tweet them to Lulu at Lulu Freistadt on Twitter. That's LuluFreistadt. The report can be found at electoralsysteminCrisis.org. You can also tweet them to me at Allison Rose Levy or notate on my Facebook page of the same name if you would like to have Lulu back on the show and are ready to call in or tweet us a bunch of questions that we can specifically answer, because you know, this is an ongoing action. This is a very complete analysis. I think it's very clearly written and really makes a lot of sense. But, you know, for any of us with math anxiety to whom any of this is new or, you know, kind of concerned about the actual subject matter, happy to, you know, make sure you get all of the help you need. And also I'm sure that will be provided if you get involved in the action. And part of the actions, I'm sure, upcoming on Tuesdays up to the election and beyond will be also educating people to how to make sure our votes count and use them to get a handle on democracy. Thank you so much, Lulu Freistadt, for being with us again the second time on Connect the Dots. Thank you so much.
Yeah, such a pleasure to be here, Allison. Thank you so much for the work you're doing.
Yeah, your work is extraordinary. And for those who'd like to hear our first shorter piece, it's in the Connect the Dot archives. If you type into your browser Connect the Dot Podbean, you'll go right to it, as well as this show will be available in archives to pass along to your friends within a day or so of this live broadcast. And please do pass the information along. And so we'll sign off for this week's Connect the Dots. Thank you, listeners, for being with us. And come back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy, wishing you to be well and active in the coming week.
And there was night. There was light. There was me, but there was the sky. And there in the tree that crawled alive.
Sambele umma lueru.
Mambele
umma lueru. Umma lueru. Umma lueru.
Umma lueru.
Chapo.
Umma lueru. Umma lueru.